Mostly sunny, much cooler, highs in the upper 40s to low 50s.
Good morning. The election is so close, the last few people who decide to vote may make the difference. How does a Pennsylvania pastor persuade young people that the process matters to them? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Pastor runs a church with a history as old as the American Revolution and tries to attract new voters. I'm Michelle Martin in Philadelphia.
And I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington. Israeli airstrikes last night blew up Lebanese bank branches linked to Hezbollah. Also, how did Colombia work birdsong into its national anthem? And we have some TV viewing for Halloween. It's Monday, October 21st, the birthday of New York's Guggenheim Museum. The giant spiral of art designed by Frank Lloyd Wright opened 65 years ago in 1959. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Vice President Harris was in Georgia yesterday campaigning at black churches near Atlanta. As NPR's Tamara Keith reports, the events were part of Harris's broader campaign to turn out the vote in this year's presidential election.
At New Birth Missionary Baptist Church in Stonecrest, Georgia, Harris told her own faith story and tied today's political moment to the Bible story of the Good Samaritan.
Are all people of faith living those words? Are all people of faith expressing those words in their actions? Do we have leaders in place who understand that in the face of a stranger, one should see a neighbor?
In his sermon, Pastor Jamal Bryant told thousands gathered in the sanctuary and watching online that voting is an exercise of faith. Tamara Keith, NPR News, traveling with the vice president.
Former President Donald Trump campaigned in Pennsylvania yesterday. His events included a staged stop at a McDonald's fast food restaurant north of Philadelphia. That's where Trump spent time working the fry station and speaking to customers through the drive-thru window. Tech billionaire Elon Musk is giving out $1 million to one Pennsylvania voter each day until Election Day. Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro and some law experts say this might be illegal. NPR's Luke Garrett has more.
On Saturday, Musk presented a Pennsylvania voter a giant check for $1 million during a campaign event. All the winner had to do was register to vote and sign Musk's political petition. Governor Shapiro told NBC News that this move was deeply concerning.
I think it's something that law enforcement could take a look at. I'm not the attorney general anymore of Pennsylvania. I'm the governor, but it does raise some serious questions.
UCLA election law professor Rick Hassan says Musk's daily election sweepstakes are, quote, clearly illegal.
This is essentially a lottery that's open only to people who register to vote. So it's either an incentive for someone to vote or it's a reward. And either way, it violates federal law.
The tech mogul Super PAC did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Musk says the goal of this prize money is to support the Constitution. Luke Garrett, NPR News, Washington.
Parts of southern New Mexico are still under flood warning after torrential flooding killed at least two people over the weekend. Officials in Chavez County, home to the city of Roswell, say hundreds of other people had to be rescued. One of the people who got stranded was the Chavez County Sheriff.
Chavez County Sheriff Mike Harrington. At this time, I am sitting on the roof of my cop car, my police truck. I am completely surrounded by water.
That audio is from the Chavez County Sheriff. The New Mexico National Guard was deployed to help with water rescues. You're listening to NPR. The Israeli military is striking targets in Lebanon. It says it's aiming at financial facilities used by Hezbollah militants. One of the strikes is at a financial institution used by regular Lebanese civilians. The strikes come as Secretary of State Antony Blinken leaves today on his latest trip to Israel and other Mideast countries. Tropical Storm Oscar is thrashing Cuba with storm surge and flash flooding. Emily Green reports as Oscar pounds Cuba, the island is in the throes of a massive power outage that has left millions of Cubans without electricity since Friday.
A malfunction at a major power plant near Havana has left millions without electricity for three full days. Residents say their food is spoiling, they have no electricity to charge their cell phones, or even to listen to the radio to get news about what's going on. It's like we're in a horror movie, said Claribel, a Cuban resident whose last name NPR is withholding because of the risk of retaliation from the government. Exacerbating what is already a terrible situation, Oscar is bringing heavy rains and dangerous storm surge. For NPR News, I'm Emily Green in Mexico City.
A member of the Little Rock Nine students who helped integrate an Arkansas high school has died. Thelma Mothershed Ware died in a Little Rock hospital of multiple sclerosis, according to her sister. She was 83. In 1957, Mothershed Ware was among the students initially blocked from entering Central High School by Arkansas's governor. He used National Guard troops to keep the students out. Former President Dwight Eisenhower then sent U.S. Army troops to escort the Little Rock Nine inside. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Arm, committed to delivering innovative, advanced computing designed to enable worldwide companies to unleash the capabilities and experiences of AI. The future of AI is built on Arm. Arm.com. This is NPR.
At KAXE, we keep it local.
It's kind of hard to get new work put out because, you know, it's a risk. People don't, without the name recognition, people are, I think, more reluctant.
This is Migrating Warblers in Bemidji.
Hi, you guys. Always part of the cheese gang. Good to hear from you.
The cheese gang, yeah. And I'm going to give a shout out to all the members of KAXE.
How long does a loon live?
That's a great question. Mm-hmm. There are loons that have been documented to be over 30 years old, so they are a very long-lived species. But typically,
I'm Andrew DeZingle. We need your support to keep it local. Text word DONATE to 218-326-1234. Thank you.
Rattling raspberry canes, only brambles remain. An old farmhouse, weathered frame. Same old story, ain't got no name. We're leaving today, and tomorrow comes rain when they tear.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Michelle Martin, coming to you from WHYY in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Steve and I have been traveling around this swing state talking with voters. In a few minutes, I'll tell you about my visit with a pastor and community activist in Allentown. He's trying to persuade voters who still are not interested in this election that they should be.
First, we follow up on the release of secret documents about Israel. The documents discuss Israeli preparations to attack Iran. Israelis have said Iran will pay for missile attacks on Israel. And the documents appeared over the weekend on Telegram, a popular social media channel in many parts of the world. NPR's Greg Myrie is covering the story. Greg, good morning.
Hi, Steve.
First, what are the leaked materials?
So we're talking about two U.S. intelligence documents, apparently based on spy satellite photographs, and they describe plans for Israel to hit Iran, as you noted. So the actual photographs are not part of these documents, but the documents describe what it calls the Israeli preparations, such as practicing mid-air refueling by military planes and the movements of Israeli weapons like missiles and drones. The documents don't describe what Israel might do, what kind of actual attack it might carry out. Still, this is setting off alarm bells because this such sensitive material made it onto this Telegram channel called the Middle East Spectator, and it, which is sympathetic to Iran.
Yeah, so how did this stuff get out?
Yeah, Steve, we don't know, and the intelligence community isn't saying. They are investigating. One suspicion is that it was leaked by a U.S. government officials, but we want to stress this is There's no confirmation at this point. The documents were apparently prepared by the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, or NGA. We don't often hear about the NGA, but it does this critical work of examining satellite photographs. The NGA is not commenting, but a former intelligence official who spoke with our colleague Tom Bowman has seen the documents on Telegram and says they are authentic.
So I'm trying to figure this out, and we should note that secrets are not secrets forever. If Israel had already attacked Iran, this information wouldn't be of that great interest. But Israel has not yet acted, and now some kind of information is out. Is this likely to cause Israel to delay or change or recalibrate its plans?
Yeah, we don't know, and they're not saying. I mean, even before this document episode, the possible Israeli actions were pretty widely discussed publicly.
Yeah.
Israel has promised a tough response. The Biden administration has been pressing Israel to not attack Iran's oil operations or nuclear facilities, saying this could further escalate the conflict. An official familiar with these discussions has told NPR Israel is not planning to hit either of those facilities and will instead focus on Iranian military sites. So it's been almost 3 weeks since the Iranian missile attack. We don't know when the Israelis will respond. Could come at any time. We are expecting it before the U.S. elections in about 2 weeks.
How is the suspense over that possible attack affecting the region more broadly?
Well, you know, I think the really important thing to remember here, Steve, is we're entering this dangerous new territory with Israel and Iran striking each other directly. You know, the type of Israeli response may well determine whether this round of direct attacks is over or whether it will continue and potentially escalate.
And Press Greg Myrie, thanks so much.
Sure thing, Steve.
In the shadow of an historic steeple presiding over a street in Allentown, Pennsylvania, I talk with the founder of an organization trying to encourage young people, especially young people of color, to become more politically active.
Yeah, there's a Liberty Bell Shrine.
Our conversation with the Reverend Gregory Edwards comes with a brief tour of his congregation's new home. There are elegantly carved pews, elaborate glass-stained windows, and in the basement, a replica of the Liberty Bell.
It's very loud if you ring it. Very, very, very loud.
I kind of want to hear it.
Okay.
This is the former home of a church where the Continental Congress hid the original Liberty Bell from the British in 1777. Today, it's a predominantly black congregation, Resurrected Life Community Church, which Edwards leads as senior pastor while also leading a community organizing initiative downtown.
You're in the business district, what some folks call the heart of Allentown. That's arguable, but it's, you know, home is where the heart is.
Reverend Edwards tells us the center of his city looks very different than it did a few years ago, just like the people who attend services at this church. But some things have not changed, which is why he's partnering with some 300 congregations throughout the area. It's the battleground of the battleground, which Pennsylvania has become.
So the Lehigh Valley has about 600,000 people. The cities, Allentown, Bethlehem, and Easton, they're all held in office by Democrats. But all of the surrounding areas, all of them are very red, which makes for purple.
So it's not that people change their minds. It's not that the people change. It's a question of who gets their people out.
Who gets
their
people out?
You're a pastor, you're a community organizer, right. And all of the above. Do you feel like you have a role in this right
here? I mean, I'm doing everything I can to be able to have folk that are in my universe understanding what's at stake, but also having conversations with rightfully cynical folk that have been led to believe that life hasn't changed for them, whether it was Barack Obama that looked like them or Donald Trump that really didn't give a about them. They're saying, how does voting impact me? So
what do you say?
I have to acknowledge their cynicism. I mean, they're rightfully cynical because I get it. They don't understand what's at risk. All they understand is that when they go to the grocery store, they keep getting less in the bag than more. That's not a 5-minute conversation. That's a let's come to the house and have a dinner talk, right? So I think that there's not been an investment in deep relational organizing that really helps politicize people so that they're not feeling like they're invisible and disposable.
There's been a lot of talk about the move among at least some young African Americans and Latinos for Trump. You think it's more discouragement? It's more that people just aren't feeling it?
I think they're not feeling it. And I think that when there's someone that intentionally has messaged about the whole notion about black jobs. And that's not just him coming up with that. It's him being in relationship with folk that are saying, yeah, the reason why black folks are struggling is because there's a new minority group that's entering the country illegally. They've been messaged that. That's intentional.
Do you think it's interesting that Trump, of all people, rich, inherited wealth, legacy wealth, never been poor a day in his life, probably never cooked his own meal, has tapped into something that people who presumably are more in tune have not? Do you think that there's something interesting about that?
I think when someone says, yeah, government's broke, you're right, it ain't working. I mean, I think there's brothers in the barbershop, there's folks on the basketball courts that are like, yeah, this broke. Now, are they connecting the dots between police brutality, who's the DA, and me not voting, so that that informs what the police officer does? I don't know if they're collecting the dots on that, but I think that there's a general cynicism about government. And I think when you have a political character that comes forth and says, yeah, this broke, it's right, I think it messages to folk that have been left out, like, yeah, it's broke, and they're coming after me, and they're going to come after you. I think that there's folk that are like, yeah, he's right. Or, oh, he's such a renegade. He's so outspoken. He's not like the polished Harvard pedigree. I think that there's some of that too. And we're having conversations between folk who are legacy civil rights voters who we know are going to vote and some of their grandchildren who are like, I ain't feeling it. And what we've learned through research is you can't shame them. You can't put your finger in folk who are really economically suffering and say, well, you should vote. And we fought for this. And I have institutional memory of Dr. King, Ella Baker, Fannie Lou Hamer, Malcolm X. I have John Lewis, but that's a generation or two removed from my children. So we have to show up, and we gotta do it, like we do it year round. We can't do it simply 2 weeks before the most consequential election of our lifetime.
That's the Reverend Gregory Edwards. He is the senior pastor of Resurrected Life Community Church. He also leads an initiative to encourage more civic engagement. Later this week, we're going to hear from Latino voters in Allentown and some super voters in Bethlehem with their take on why their communities have become the focus of such pitched political battles.
Women who show up for mammograms are gauging their risk of breast cancer, and it turns out they have an opportunity to gauge their risk of another disease. Jackie Fortier with our partner KFF Health News has the story.
Breast x-rays, better known as mammograms, are typically used to detect breast cancer, but the pictures also show whether arteries in the breast have calcified.
It looks like a thickened white line.
That's Dr. Heather Johnson. She's a preventative cardiologist in Boca Raton, Florida. She says those thick white lines are sometimes associated with heart disease risk and are unrelated to breast cancer. They've been visible on mammograms for decades, but the information hasn't typically been shared with patients. Johnson says women want to know.
They want to be aware and also be able to have the next steps available to address it.
At Dr. Johnson's practice, looking for calcifications in the arteries of the breast is part of a routine mammogram and doesn't cost extra. But some mammography practices are charging, sometimes over $100, to have artificial intelligence algorithms look for those calcifications. Often, this extra cost isn't covered by insurance, says Dr. Sadia Khan. She's a preventative cardiologist in Chicago.
It should raise a flag. Why isn't a health insurance company paying for it? Probably because the evidence isn't strong enough to suggest that they should be paying for it.
Heart disease is the number one killer of women in the United States. But Khan says looking for calcifications in breast arteries is not a proven screening tool.
Just because you have breast artery calcification does not mean you have calcification in your heart arteries or have heart disease, and vice versa. So the false reassurance is also a potential concern.
How can you tell if you're at risk of heart disease? You can fill out an online risk calculator with your doctor. There's one on the American Heart Association's website. It takes into account your blood pressure, cholesterol, and weight, among other health indicators. These are proven metrics that can point to a risk of heart disease. And it's free. I'm Jackie Fortier in Los Angeles.
Jackie with KFF Health News. Michelle Andrews also contributed. This is NPR News.
morning. It is 6:19. Thanks for listening to the Monday Morning Show on KAXC. I'm Jennifer Barr. Chris Walker will be my co-host today. It is the first day of our Come Home to KAXC Fall Membership Drive. We are your community radio station that keeps you connected to Northern Minnesota. Whether it's local news, great music, or thoughtful conversations, KAXC is here because of listeners like you. You can donate now at KAXC.org to keep your home on the dial strong and thriving. Thank you so much. We are doing a ticket drawing today for everybody who donates before 3:30. We will have tickets to give away for the Trampled by Turtles and Avett Brothers concert that's happening this Saturday at XL Energy Center in St. Paul. You can opt into that when you give right now at KAXC.org. Also, gifts of $20 a month or more will get our new Sounds Like Home KAXC t-shirt. You can check that out at our website, KAXC.org. Coming up in about an hour, we will have Events Up North, a closer look at some of the events happening this week. It will be Bat Week starting October 24th. The Chippewa National Forest invites you to the Deer River District Office on Thursday from 3 to 5 or the Norway Beach Visitor Center near Cass Lake from 5 to 7. You can learn about bat conservation efforts in the forest and make your own bat ears. We continue now with Morning Edition on KAXC.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Focus Features, presenting Conclave, based on the novel, starring Ralph Fiennes, Stanley Tucci, John Lithgow, and Isabella Rossellini. Directed by Edward Berger, in theaters everywhere this Friday. From Workday, with AI at the core of its system, Workday is committed to delivering continuous innovation to prepare organizations for what's next. Workday, an enterprise platform for finance and HR rock stars. From Fisher Investments, as a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez.
I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. The United Nations Biodiversity Conference starts today in Colombia, one of the most biodiverse countries on Earth. It has more bird species than any other country and the second most butterflies and amphibians. Now these natural wonders can be heard in a new version of Colombia's national anthem. John Otis reports.
National anthems are often hard to sing and rather ponderous. Colombia's is no exception. In Spanish, they're singing, "Oh, unwithering glory, oh, immortal jubilance, in furrows of pain, goodness now germinates." It goes on like this for 11 stanzas, which is why hardly any Colombians know all the words. But a new version of the song has been released to coincide with the UN Biodiversity Conference taking place in the Colombian city of Cali. It's sung mostly by birds. The project is the brainchild of Sura, an insurance company that's one of the sponsors of the summit. It commissioned biologists to record sounds in the mountains and jungles, which were then handed over to Bogota music producer Miguel de Narvaez.
First of all, we have to respect each note of the national anthem. It was a real challenge because birds or animals are not pitched to sing in a specific tune or something.
His team got some unexpected help from a pygmy owl known in Colombia as a ferruginio.
It appeared suddenly, and the biologists say, "Oh no, a ferruginio." So they stepped out of the car and recorded it, and he starts. Fa-ba-da-da. That first note is the owl.
Dozens of other animals chime in.
There are 41 birds, 3 frogs, 1 jaguar, and whales.
The whales were key for the anthem's harmony.
For example, the whale, whoa, that sound gives a floor to the melody.
The retooled anthem is a way to call attention to an unprecedented crisis in which habitats are vanishing and up to 1 million species around the planet face extinction. Narvaez says it also appears to be catching on.
One person told me, this is the first time I've heard the national anthem so many times because I love it. I love this version.
For NPR News, I'm John Otis in Bogota, Colombia. There are lots of ways to experience the end of October. Maybe you're enjoying the well-stocked Halloween candy aisle. Maybe you meticulously craft costumes for the next 10 days. Or maybe you just like to watch your vampires and witches on screen. Glenn Weldon, host of NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast, is here for you with a couple of TV series airing right now that focus on the fun side of Halloween. So, Glenn, let's start with what you call the funniest show on TV. No argument from me, the FX series What We Do in the Shadows.
Absolutely. Consistently the funniest show has been for years. This, as you know, is a fake documentary series about a bunch of hapless, hilarious, not remotely terrifying vampires who are spending their immortal lives together as roommates in a group house on Staten Island. And it's back for its sixth and final season today. And this season they introduce a brand new character, their old vampire roommate, Jerry, who's been asleep for a long time. I'm not going to spoil how he comes back because it's pretty funny, but I will say that when he does, he's puzzled by some of the choices his roommates have made while he's been away.
We lurk in the darkness, concealing our own grim majesty from prying human eyes. And those who are too curious, well, they'll spend their last moments rueing the day they poked their noses in where they weren't belonging.
What he said.
Right. But then why is there a human camera crew here filming everything?
Now, Glenn, sometimes when a series gets as far as What We Do in the Shadows has gotten, sixth season, particularly a high-concept series like this one, where the premise is kind of really out there, I mean, you start to feel a little bit of wear and tear. Is that an issue here?
No, actually, because Jerry gives the rest of the vampires a renewed sense of purpose. It's very smart, because that's exactly what a show like this needs in its final seasons as it's going into the home stretch. Each character gets a new project. One of them goes back to his old mad scientist ways. Another tries to go undercover in the corporate world. As you can imagine, that does not go well. Look, this show has been nominated for Best Comedy and Best Writing for a Comedy Series again and again. And this year, Matt Berry, who we heard there, is nominated for Best Lead Actor in a Comedy, but it has never won an Emmy, which is mystifying, because if it were up to me, this show would get pelted with an unceasing barrage of every award possible.
Okay, so that's vampires. There's another series with Halloween vibes right now. And even though it's part of the Marvel superhero universe, it's called Agatha All Along. I loved how this thing originally began with the first series, WandaVision. Tell us about Agatha.
Well, yeah, I mean, to your point, Marvel TV has been hit or miss, but that first one, WandaVision, was the best. That took Elizabeth Olsen's Scarlet Witch character from the Avengers films and kind of riffed on classic sitcoms in a very funny way. The bad guy in that series was the witch Agatha Harkness, played by Catherine Hahn. In Agatha All Along, Hahn's back, and she's trying to regain her magic powers through a series of trials. But to do that, she has to form a coven who are played by actors who are so entirely my jam, that I think the Marvel folks have been reading my diary. You got Sashir Zameda, Aubrey Plaza, and Patty freaking Lupone. This show is very funny. It's very dark. It's got comics fans excited because it's becoming kind of a whistle-stop tour of the darker, more horror-inflected corners of the Marvel Universe that we haven't seen on screen before, big or small. It's also pretty unabashedly queer for just a lot of reasons, but not least of which is this one. On this show, the way that Agatha begins that series of trials that will restore her magic is with, wait for it, a musical number.
Down, down, down the road, down the witch's road. Road, circle soul with fate.
I feel like I should be at the Pantages Theater, Glenn. I mean, talk about Halloween vibes.
There you go. It's not just Halloween vibes. It's Halloween meets Broadway. I mean, look, Halloween has always been the gayest holiday, but then you throw in Patti LuPone as a witch belting a close harmony power ballad in a minor key. Hey, I'm a gay nerd. I'm powerless against this. It's like Happy Halloween. Know what I'm saying?
Absolutely. Glenn Weldon hosts NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast. Glenn, thank you.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
Foreign governments are increasingly trying to silence critics overseas, including here in the U.S.
I have been threatened directly by the Indian parliamentarians while sitting in the Indian parliament.
We hear from one American activist about how being the target of an alleged assassination plot has changed his life. on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered starts at 4 o'clock this afternoon with your local host, Andrew DeZingle. Good morning. It is the Monday morning show on KAXE. It is 6:29. I'm Jennifer Barr. It is the first day of our fall membership drive. Come home to KAXE. We've got so many exciting things going on this week. And today we do have a ticket drawing for a concert that's happening this Thursday at the XL Energy Center in St. Paul. It's Trampled by Turtles and the Avett Brothers together, both doing full sets. You can enter that drawing right now by donating at kaxc.org. We'll be drawing for that those tickets this afternoon during mixtape with Malachi Coons at about 3:45. So be sure to get your donation in before that, by 3:30, let's say. We've also got some great new thank you gifts to offer you. You can check that out at kaxc.org. That's a great place to give right now. You can click that donate button. Our temperatures right now range from 40 in Hibbing to 49 in Brainerd. It is 44 in Grand Rapids and Aiken, 42 in Bemidji. We receive support from FixCon Roofing, professionally trained roofers committed to using local building suppliers for your custom roofing needs in northern Minnesota. More online at FIKSCON.com. Coming up at about 7:45, we'll have What We're Reading with Tammy Bobrowski. Today, a conversation with Minnesota author Jill Hannah Anderson. And coincidentally, her book is called Closer to Home. That's kind of what we're celebrating this week during our fall membership drive. You can also answer our question of the week: what food or foods remind you of home? You can text in 218-326-1234. Coming up right now, we've got Minnesota Native News.
This is Minnesota Native News. I'm Murray Rock. Every fall, the city of Roseville holds a wild rice festival. As Chandra Colvin explains, the goal of the festival is to teach people the importance of wild rice and the deep history and connections it has within Minnesota's indigenous communities.
Paul Rice and his cousin use a long wooden mixing paddle to stir the freshly gathered wild rice in an iron kettle over an open flame. A crowd gathers as they explain the process of harvesting manumen, the Ojibwe word for wild rice. This step of the process is known as parching.
We cook it for about an hour, less than an hour, not doing batches. And then we let it cool a little bit, and then we lay it on a tarp, and we dance the rice, trying to get the shell broke off from the rice.
Every year, Roseville's Harriet Alexander Nature Center holds a festival to teach Minnesotans about wild rice. More specifically, its connection to indigenous people and our state's history.
It's traditional. It's a way of life for us. I can't imagine being without wild rice. You know, it's important to us. Reminds me of the family, you know, all my cousins and uncles and everybody else has been involved in this process.
Paul is a band member of the White Earth Nation. For 5 years, he has been providing demonstrations to show how manumen is prepared for eating, but not with modern machinery. They prepare the rice traditionally by hand from start to finish. He says they've been doing this since he was a young boy.
We've been doing it for 40, 50 years, you know, just in my lifetime, and maybe 100 years before that.
Dion Hyder is the program supervisor at the Harriet Alexander Nature Center.
We have a variety of vendors that are here, primarily indigenous crafters. We also have some dancers. We have some songs and games in Ojibwe, some card games. We've got some nature journaling activities going on.
The festival even has taste testing, where people can try to tell the difference between traditionally harvested wild rice and processed wild rice.
the traditionally harvested rice is the winner in terms of taste. So we try to talk about that and the cultural significance of that as a food, but also that it can be delicious and that people should try to look for the traditionally harvested rice when they can.
Robert Rice is Paul's brother. He owns Powwow Grounds in Minneapolis right off of Franklin Avenue. He recently rolled out with a brand new food truck called Fry Bread Factory. He incorporates wild rice throughout his menu.
So if you see wild rice in the store, it'll usually say cultivated, and it's like just black. And that to me isn't wild rice. That's cultivated stuff, and it's, to me, it's tasteless.
He tends to harvest his own rice for his recipes, such as wild rice, muffins, bread, or soup.
Got a very nutty flavor, smoky, because we do ours over a wood fire. There are differences between White Earth and Leech Lake and Boys Fort, and some will be a little more muddy, some will be longer grain. So there are some differences there. There are some that you can pop. And what I mean by popping is that just like popcorn, people will pop the wild rice and then put it on a salad.
Alongside his brother Paul, they harvested rice with their family. For many Indigenous people in Minnesota, their story and relationship to wild rice is very similar. It's a way of life.
This was my 50th year harvesting rice. Before that, my dad did. Before him, my grandpa did. I was blessed with the name Rice for a last name, so I guess I'm stuck with it.
For Minnesota Native News, I'm Chandra Colvin.
Minnesota Native News is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and the citizens of Minnesota.
You can find more at minnesotanativenews.org. I'm Jennifer Barr. Thanks so much for tuning in to the Monday Morning Show. We are kicking off our fall membership drive today, and I forgot to mention earlier that our first four donations this morning will unlock a $500 match thanks to the generous support of KAXZ's Board of Directors. You can give by texting the word donate to 218-326-1234 or visit our website kaxz.org. Our weather for today, sunny, highs in the upper 70s, southeast winds 5 to 10, mostly cloudy overnight, slight chance for showers in northwest Minnesota, including the Bemidji area, lows in the upper 50s, and tomorrow, chance of showers and thunderstorms, high 65 to 70, and lows tomorrow night down to about 32 to 35, and then on Wednesday, sunny, much cooler, highs in the upper 40s, breezy northwest winds 10 to 20, gusting higher. We've received support from the Green Heron Bed and Breakfast, a four-season B&B on Pekagama Lake, featuring home-cooked meals and all the amenities needed for a complete family vacation. More information at greenheronbnb.com. The gong means we had a donation. Thank you so much to Susan in Mattawa becoming a member this morning. She did that online at kaxz.org. Getting us off to a great start, that means we only need three more to unlock our $500 match. Again, thanks to the generous donations from our board of directors. Now we're going to hear from Laura Erickson, who speaks for the birds. She recently returned from the American Ornithological Society's annual meeting.
Attending this year's American Ornithological Society meeting was a much different experience than any of my previous professional meetings, much better in some ways and not so much in a few other ways. I was 26 years old when I attended the AOU meeting in Madison, much younger than the average attendee with twice as many X chromosomes, though I did match the prevailing color. Things hadn't changed much through the next few decades, but now at the 2024 meeting, I was one of the very oldest attendees, and this time the people who attended looked much more like America. So a great many attendees were not white, straight, or male. Indeed, there's now a group called the Rainbow Lorikeets for LGBTQIA+ members and their allies. Making ornithology more inclusive has been good not only for human beings, it's had an amazing effect on the science of ornithology itself. What had been accepted as scientific truth for centuries, that males are the only birds who select and defend a territory, sing, and so many other important activities, was suddenly shown to be utterly wrong, thanks in large part to scientists questioning those old wives, male ornithologists' tales. And fresh new blood of all stripes has brought a refreshing focus on conservation to what had been, in many ways, and again for centuries, a boys' shoot-'em-up club. Even as collecting specimens via shotgun became both less palatable to mainstream ornithologists and laden with legal constraints thanks to the Migratory Bird Act, for most of its history, many or even most scientists calling themselves ornithologists were prickly about equating any issues of bird mortality, especially regarding domestic cats and collisions with windows and other obstructions, with conservation. For the first few decades of my own career, mainstream conservation organizations such as Audubon and the American Bird Conservancy ignored or even poo-pooed the importance of cats and window collisions, and scientists at the AOU itself rejected papers submitted to the AUC by Dr. Daniel Clem about window mortality, dismissing his work as inconsequential and without significant conservation value. Many of the ornithologists when I was starting out had done a lot of scientific collecting themselves. Some took advantage of birds killed at windows on campuses and in big cities to add to their scientific collections, and it was impossible for most of them to concede any value in individual bird life, nor how losing enough individuals can add up to population losses. Some scientists have explained to me that conservation issues are emotional and political, while science is supposed to be entirely rational, as if the uses of scientific information are not at all emotional or political. Scientists also seem to focus on some unwritten law of scientific neutrality that isn't really neutral at all. Ornithologists and even major conservation organizations have historically shied away from supporting the conservation side of controversial issues, while corporations don't seem to have any trouble at all finding ornithologists in good standing to defend their side. For the first two or three decades that Dan Clem was publishing research about how dangerous windows are to birds, leading up to his conclusion that up to a billion birds are killed by windows every year in the United States, and for years after Sidney Gautreau published his radar data indicating that major migration movements of birds over the Gulf of Mexico had declined by 50% in just two decades, major conservationists were poo-pooing those numbers. When those same naysayers independently came up with pretty much the exact same figures and conclusions, they took credit for the discovery of how dire things really are, giving no credit whatsoever to Clem or Gautreau. At this 2024 meeting, I attended one AOS session pulling together representatives from various conservation groups. When I expressed how hard it was to get ornithologists on board to help fight controversial battles, giving several examples, I got no suggestions about how to encourage ornithologists with PhDs after their names to take a larger role in helping with these issues, just a patronizing thank you for your passion before they quickly moved on. But with so much new blood in the American Ornithological Society and such an increasing focus on conservation, things are changing. I just hope it won't be too little, too late. I'm Laura Erickson, speaking for the birds.
You can find more at lauraerickson.com. It is 6:44. Thanks for listening to the Monday Morning Show on KAXC. I'm Jennifer Barr. We receive support from ICTV. ICTV connects, informs, and empowers the community through diverse media. Learn more at watchictv.org. It is the first day of our fall membership drive. Again, we want to thank Susan from Mattawa getting us off to a great start this morning. That means we need to hear from at least three more of you to unlock a match from our board of directors. Thanks so much for their generosity. Also, remember, we are doing a ticket giveaway today, this afternoon during Mixtape with Malachi Coons. All gifts before 3:30 this afternoon will be entered to win, if you so choose. Tickets to a concert this Thursday evening at the XL Energy Center in St. Paul. It is both Trampled by Turtles and the Avett Brothers. You can enter to win. Again, you can give us a call, 218-326-1234. Volunteer Janet is here to take your calls, or if you prefer to give online, you can visit kaxc.org. Coming up this weekend on Stay Human, we're getting ready for Halloween with stories told live at Clacko Brewing's Storytelling Sunday. The theme for this month's event was eerie. We have a piece from Bemidji writer Marsh Muirhead about scaring himself in the dark. And we will get to that in just a few moments here on KAXC. Actually, right now we're going to take a listen to our album of the week. It is by Rubble Bucket. The album's called Year of the Banana, and this is the seventh album from this Brooklyn-based dance rock band. The two primary members of the band are vocalist and multi-instrumentalist Kalmia Travers and Alex Troth. Many of the lyrics are taken from poems that Travers wrote during that period, dealing with their changing relationship and the ways they worked through it. You can let us know what you think of our album of the week. Text us 218-326-1234. The song we're going to hear this morning from Rubble Bucket is called Morning Glory Blanket. from our album of the week, Year of the Banana by Rubble Bucket. That song was called Morning Glory Blanket. You can let us know what you think. Text us 218-326-1234. You can also answer our question of the week, what foods remind you of home? 218-326-1234. You can also become a member right now. We are in the very first hours of our fall membership drive. Come home to KAXZ. You can get entered in that ticket drawing. You can help us unlock a $500 match from our board of directors. We've already heard from Susan in Mattawa this morning. You can be next. Give us a call, 218-326-1234. Right now, we'll have a preview of next week's Stay Human. We'll have stories told live at Clacko Brewing Storytelling Sunday with the theme of Eerie. Here is Marsh Muirhead scaring himself in the dark.
I was obsessed with horror movies as a young kid. I was 8 or 9 when my father took me to see The House on Haunted Hill with Vincent Price on a night when my mother was at her bridge club. When a hideous witch rolled out of the darkness, I nearly jumped out of my seat. Some ladies sitting behind us said to my dad, "Don't you think he's a bit young for this?" But not long after that, my cousin and I went to see The Blob, about a crawling mass of quivering goo, which grew each time it struck, like a snake, an unsuspecting victim. It liked the night, lurched out of the bushes and parks, consuming a man walking his dog, and then suddenly rose up and into a park convertible, dissolving the lovers in the back seat. Them was about giant ants, the result of radiation tests. They were the size of cattle, and they emerged from their nests in the desert of the Southwest, making these weird cheeping noises and breaking into rural homes, consuming the inhabitants with their pincher-like mouths, making crunching sounds. So creepy was the original invasion of the body snatchers. I had to tell the kids at school about it, over lunch and recess. How people were somehow infected while sleeping, their bodies turning into a pod which cracked open, and their duplicate, but now alien, emerged when they woke. At parent-teacher conferences, my parents were told about complaints by other parents that I was scaring their children, and I was forbidden from repeating horror stories at school. As I got older and the movies seemed to be even more believable and terrifying, I remained a fan of the dark side. The Exorcist was the most terrifying and the first and best at demonic possession. I thought it might be true, and when the furnace kicked on late on the night I saw the movie, I thought it was the beginning of my own possession. Some of you might remember Angel Heart, when Mickey Rourke sold his soul to the devil to be a famous singer, or Rosemary's Baby, when Mia Farrow and her husband, played by John Cassavetes, were looking forward in her pregnancy, but of course, it wasn't a normal pregnancy at all. He was out there, Lucifer, the Prince of Darkness. The first of the Halloween movies was so suspenseful I had to look down at the corner of the movie screen as Michael Myers stalked Jamie Lee Curtis in the darkened house with that creepy music in the background. And Hannibal Lecter in Silence of the Lambs, another serial killer, the kind of guy that might actually be having a beer downtown right now. Hello, Clarice. Did you see the original Night of the Living Dead, the first one in black and white? It was nonstop terror from the opening scene in the cemetery. They're coming to get you, Barbara. This was the first of the great zombie movies, and they were coming for everyone, all of us. Much of what passes for fictional horror is actually possible. Bizarre creatures, scientific mistakes, raw evil, madness run amok. You might think you are safe right now, driving to some errand on a Saturday morning, watching Sunday football, preparing supper, but don't be so sure. Did you notice that car with the tinted windows following you rather suspiciously? Did you hear that noise in the basement last night? Is tonight the night you'll get that phone call, just heavy breathing, from inside your house?
That is Bemidji area writer Marsh Muirhead. You can tune in for more stories from area writers and storytellers every week on Stay Human, Saturday mornings at 9 and Sunday evenings at 5. It is the Monday Morning Show on KAXC. I'm Jennifer Barr. Chris Walker joins me now. Good morning.
Good morning, Jennifer. Happy Fall Member Drive Week.
Yes, very exciting. We've already heard from Susan in Mattawa this morning. We just need to hear from three more to unlock our match from our board of directors. Thanks to their generous support, we'll unlock an additional $500 if we can hear from three more of you. We know we can hear from more than that, as for sure.
That's right. We'll take baby steps. But yeah, just a few more for that first match. Thanks to our board of directors for that. And I'm really excited to be here for this first day of the member drive, because there's so much happening, Jennifer.
So much happening.
We have a new t-shirt we're excited to offer up to donations at a certain amount. You can check it out on KAXE.org and just click the donate button. And of course, the concert tickets we're excited to give away that our music team was able to snag with the big one today, the Trampled by Turtles Avid Brothers show. I'm very excited for that. And of course, if you donate, you get automatic entry into that drawing later today with Malachi Coons, a mixtape.
Yeah, he's doing a mixtape with songs about home. That's kind of what we're all about. We feel like home, I think KAXE does to a lot of people. Especially, we've heard, you know, people that come up north and they're like, I know I'm reaching Northern Minnesota when I get to tune into KAXE.
Yeah, you talk about the theme. Our theme is come home to KAXE, and that means so many different things for so many different people. Those of us who live here, of course, coming home to the station, whether it's coming home from a day of work, of course, our work, we're always home, if you consider that way. But those of you that come home and turn on KAXE, those of you that are, quote, coming home during work, whether you're listening to KAXE, and those listening to us from afar, my favorite thing about member drives is hearing from all the people outside of our listening area, outside of the state, sometimes even outside of the country, who tune into us and want to be members and want to support this radio station. Being a community radio station, we rely on listener support. It's our largest single source of funding. So to hear people from afar coming home to where they maybe grew up and tuned into KAXE and being able to bring it with them, that's what's really special.
Yeah, and you can support that right now. You can call 218-326-1234. Our question of the week is about what foods remind you of home. And I had posed this question to the staff late last week. You said pierogies.
Pierogies. Oh, one of my favorites. Yeah, so my family on my mom's side is of Eastern European descent. And so at my family's church every week, they would make homemade pierogies, and my mom would go and make them with a number of people and always bring them home. And we never went too adventurous with them. It was always prune or cheesy potato. And
I had no idea there were prune pierogies.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And, you know, they're really not that bad, but I always craved the cheesy potato ones.
Mm,
and then
good.
Just loaded them up with sour cream. Very, very simple. There's not much to it. Most people would probably think they're pretty bland, but for me, that's home. And that was one of my favorite meals.
Yeah. Yeah, my mom was not an adventurous cook. And, like... she always says the one vegetable my dad would eat was corn. So like we were very pretty bland, but that's comfort food to me. I had talked about a recipe called Hidden Valley Chicken, which is just minute rice and
Hidden
Valley powder and some chicken breast, and you bake it and it's nothing special, but man, it's home.
That's exactly. It's funny. Whenever my dad would cook, it was always one of two things, omelets or grilled cheese and tomato soup. And I think we may have upset my mom sometimes. I'm one of four boys, and I think we maybe got excited sometimes over just a simple grilled cheese and some dish that my mom would make. But
Well, you can answer our question.